I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
Well, hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois Community Voices, and this is another episode of Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and joining me once again is my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
Hello, it's going really well, Brandon. How are you tonight?
Not bad. I was enjoying spring, but, you know, we're supposed to get a frost tonight, so we're taking one step back, but hopefully we'll have two steps forward soon.
Right. Looking forward to some warmer weather.
Absolutely. And we also have somebody joining us for the first time here on Front Row Classics, and Eric, I will have you introduce them.
Yeah. I'd like to introduce my friend, Rahul Raghunathan, to the podcast. We took a couple of improv classes together, and he's got a beard and likes movies. So we said, hey, come talk some movies with us. And he had the wonderful suggestion to do a movie that we hadn't gotten to yet, and called one of the greatest movies of all time, and some people say even the greatest British movie of all time, The Third Man.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, sorry, Rahul, I just stomped all over you. Just go ahead and talk.
No, I'm excited to be here. And when you mentioned that you run a movie podcast, and I've been one of my passions of mine, so excited for the opportunity.
We're excited to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
It's always great to have new people on. And Rahul, there's one question we always ask everybody on our podcast for the first time, and that is, what is your favorite movie?
Yeah, this is a hard question. So, I mean, I was really into this film thing, especially in like college. So if you'd asked me then, I would have said probably like 8.5 by Fellini. That was my go-to answer. And I still do love it. Like, if I had to pick a feel-good, just comfort classic right now, I might actually go with something like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or Once Upon a Time in the West. And those are the ones that come to mind. And so that's what I'm going to stick with.
Perfectly great. Good answers. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, so for this episode, as Eric mentioned, we are talking about The Third Man from 1949. Brilliant example of British mystery thriller, and also a wonderful example of film noir. Probably one of the most upper class film noirs you'll see. And we'll get into some of that in a little bit. But Eric, before we actually get into the discussion of the film, do you want to give a plot synopsis for those who haven't seen it?
I will. I'll give a plot synopsis here. It's a film noir. It's a mystery. So there's a lot of moving parts. And we've got a lot to talk about. So I'll try to fly through this as quickly as possible and pick up.
And we usually don't say this because these movies are 60, 70, 80 years old. But this is a movie, if you haven't seen it, it's got a lot of spoilers. So if you want to watch it before we get into it, stop.
Press
now
pause.
And come back.
Yeah, we'll wait. All right. Welcome back. So this movie is, our sort of protagonist is Holly Martins, who is a pulp, Western pulp, fiction writer from the United States, who's been out of work though for a little bit and decides to take a job in Vienna, Austria, post-World War II. The job there is to work with his childhood friend, Harry Lime. So Holly makes his way to Vienna, and almost as soon as he gets off the train and goes to the apartment to visit his friend, he finds out that Harry's been killed in an automobile accident, and the funeral that had left his apartment not 10 minutes earlier. So Holly makes his way to the funeral, and there we're sort of introduced to a cast of characters. We just see their faces at the funeral, and that will all appear later on in the film. But Holly makes an acquaintance with Major Calloway, who's a British major who had been investigating the dealings of Harry Lime. And he invites Holly back to a bar after the funeral for a drink. They're accompanied by Sergeant Payne, and Holly ends up sort of drunkenly defending Harry after Major Calloway says he's better off dead because Harry was a notorious racketeer. And Holly takes a swing at Calloway and gets a punch in the face from Payne for his trouble. As Harry learns, or excuse me, again, Holly learns more about Harry Lime's death, though, he begins to find some peculiarities in the story and becomes convinced that Harry Lime was actually murdered rather than killed in this automobile accident. He begins talking to some of Harry's associates, which are a colorful cast of characters, including Baron Kurtz and Dr. Vinkel, and an individual really known as just as Mr. Popescu. So Kurtz and Vinkel, we find out, were there on the scene of the accident when Lime was killed. But then Holly Martins learns that there was a third man present at the scene of the crime as well. And this sort of becomes his fixation to figure out who the third man is. So he goes and he interviews all these characters. He also calls on Lime's old girlfriend, an actress named Anna, who sort of spark up a little bit of a relationship. We come to find out that Anna, truly in love with Harry Lime, and Harry, who loved her back, we assume that because he had fixed her passport. He had forged her papers so that she could stay in Vienna and not be assigned to a Russian territory because of her heritage. So Harry, Anna tells us a couple of anecdotes about Harry. Holly tells her a couple of anecdotes. She accidentally calls Holly Harry, and he gets pissed off, and sort of their relationship, though, throughout the rest of this movie. Moving forward with the mystery, though, Holly Martins calls on the porter in Harry Lime's building frequently, too, who comes to find out, we find out that he actually witnessed the third man who helped carry Harry away from the accident. A few scenes later, that character is dead because it's gotten out that there was information out there about this third man. After the porter's killed, though, Holly goes to see Major Calloway, who tells him all about the evil things that Harry Lime was mixed up in. The racket, we come to find out, was Harry was diluting penicillin, which has a major impact on patients who need that penicillin. It kills several of them. It permanently injures several others, including a large number of children who are in a children's hospital. And then the big reveal, we come to find out that Harry Lime is actually still alive. He appears watching Holly Martins from a doorway, and they eventually meet and they confront each other. Holly and Harry talk about the morality of what Harry had been doing, and Holly struggles with it but lets Harry go for the moment. Eventually goes back to Major Calloway and agrees to help him with a sting operation. The cost for his involvement is to let Anna escape the country with the forged passport. The sting operation doesn't go as planned. Harry escapes into the sewers where there is a chase. Sergeant Payne eventually gets shot by Harry. Harry eventually gets shot by Holly. And Holly, leaving the real funeral of Harry Lime this time, decides to pull over on the side of the road and wait for Anna, who's walking away from the funeral, who doesn't even acknowledge his existence and walks on past our lowly, at this point, protagonist. And that, in a nutshell, is the third man.
Good job. So
I've left out big chunks here that I'm sure we'll get into, too.
Yeah.
So, did my best to edit it.
Yeah. Yeah. We will. We'll start, though, with first impressions, and we'll start with Raul. What were your first impressions? When was the first time you saw it?
So, yeah, I saw this film back in college. So that was maybe, 12, 13 years ago, something like that. And yeah, my first impression was, of course, that the music and like the stylistic aspect of it, like it's the so much striking cinematography, and like the post-war setting is so real because it's shot when like it's almost verite in its like usage of Vienna, right? And so that was the first impression. And also kind of, I mean, Orson Welles is makes such a striking appearance. So I'm sure we'll get into all those things, okay. But those are the things that stuck with me at first after I first saw it.
Yep. Eric?
Yeah, similar. I had seen this. College was a little bit longer ago for me, but I had seen this around that time, or maybe just a little post college, and it stuck with me as a great film. You mentioned the cinematography, Rahul, and it is, you know, probably one of the more interestingly shot films ever, and every shot you can tell is meticulous, and it's in that way that Citizen Kane is. Every shot is meticulous, every shot was planned, not just the lighting, the perspective, the angle, how it's framed, and there's so much going into it, and there's quick cuts in it too, there's a lot of editing, but just you can tell that the love was put into the camera work. And then you combine that with a very interesting script and just wonderful performances, and this comes out to be in one of the greatest movies ever.
This is one of those movies that for me always kind of defines why I love movies, because it captures a time and place perfectly. And, you know, the post-war Vienna, you know, and it captures that perfectly, and it captures it forever. And the images that Carol Reed, and we'll talk about all of the directorial choices and stuff later, but it's a perfect cast. It's a perfect setting. It's a perfect, you know, stylistic choices that you make with the movie. And it all just blends together and makes kind of just almost a perfect movie, I would say. And we'll get into it, but yeah, just a wonderful, wonderful movie that I feel like is certainly recognized as one of the great movies, but I think because people can never decide if it's a British or American film, it gets left off so many lists and everything when you go into it. And we'll talk about that later as well, but man, it packs a punch every time you see it. I first saw it in college, and it wowed me. And watching it again, it holds up, and you always catch things that are new. I always catch something new every time I watch it. So let's get into the actual meat of the movie and talk about the characters. And we will talk about our protagonist first, Holly Martins, played by Joseph Cotten. I'm a big Joseph Cotten fan. I think he represented the all-American, you know, guy so well, and he always sort of plays variations on that theme in all the movies that he does. But I think he really is kind of our eyes and ears in the movie, and it's fun to just navigate this with him. And Eric, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on Joseph Cotten as Holly Martins?
Well, yeah, Joseph Cotten's great in this movie, and you know, we see him in Citizen Kane probably 8 years before this movie was made. Mm-hmm. And he's a great he plays a great American. What I like about how the character was written too is that he's sort of the anti noir, not anti hero, but the anti noir hero, where he's not a suave, intelligent detective who's got it all together. He's kind of bumbling in this movie, and the way that it is played is kind of subtle. But it's also funny and really watchable. You kind of root for this guy, even though he has no idea the depth that he has gotten himself into. I mean, he has really put his life on the line and dealing with some characters that are way, way worse than he would have thought they were. Really naive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to go into that, like, I like how, I mean, yeah, Joseph Cotten with, you know, his connection with Welles is definitely interesting in all those, you know, Orson Welles movies that he was in especially. But also his character being set up as like a writer of like Westerns and kind of simplistic, naive, maybe somewhat naive, but like traditional hero narratives, kind of set up as a foil to like kind of the murky morality of Europe after the war and, you know, all these horrible things that had just happened and people are still kind of working through all that trauma and all those things going on. And I think that's like a major theme in this movie. So yeah, he definitely set up as like an everyman who's like kind of diving into this mess.
But if you ever want an idea of what especially Europeans think of Americans, watch this movie, because it's, you know, we think of ourselves as Bogey in the Maltese Falcon. They think of us as Joseph Cotton writing Westerns. You know, it's just, it's a different perspective, and it's kind of jarring, but it's also truthful.
I think one of the big differences between him as a noir protagonist and a noir protagonist in other movies is most of the time with noir protagonists, they're good people who make bad decisions, and you're kind of like, oh, don't do that. But in this one, he just kind of falls into all the different situations. It's not really his choice through most of this. He's kind of being dragged around through the story. But one thing I noticed this time around was right after he gets off the train, and as he's walking into one of the buildings, he walks under a ladder, and I hadn't noticed that this time. Time around, but I'm like, yeah, that really represents it. And what does Major Calloway tell him? Like, you were born to be murdered. Get out of here.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But he really defines sort of the bumbling American, but it works because post-war Vienna is so messy, as you can see, and everything, and he is anything but neat in the way that he goes about this. So it perfectly summarizes that. Any other thoughts about Cotton before we move on? Okay, so we will move on to the leading lady of this movie, Alida Valli, who is just billed as Valli in the credits of this movie, and she plays Anna. And I think she's the most complex character in this thing, because you never know exactly where she's coming from. And Raul, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on the character of Anna?
Yeah, that's what struck me after I watched it again, because in many ways she's very unsympathetic, right? In that, like, you know, Lyme does kind of horrible things and is clearly responsible for a lot of, you know, terrible death and murder and so on. But I mean, I guess she sticks by him, and that's the thing that you wonder about, right? But I mean, she's played brilliantly. Like, you know, I thought it was like that scene where she's walking at the end and she's just so cold and distant, you know, that sticks with you, right?
Yeah. It seems to me like they're trying, and she's kind of the archetype of like an Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca, but she's got this dark side that you don't see in so many other, you know, she's not your typical like femme fatale, like you would see Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity. She's not like a cold-blooded killer, but there's something about her that is so cold and so off-putting that it's, you can't pin her down at all. Eric, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I agree that the sort of indifference to everything that's going on is unsettling. You know, she was indifferent to all of the things that Harry Lyme was messed up in. She probably didn't even ask him about it. You know, she described him as a boy who never grew up, and sort of a whimsical character when we know that he's an awful human being. And I think it's sort of encapsulated really well when she and Holly are sort of investigating what's going back on, and they go back to Harry's apartment, and she is sitting there. She doesn't care about the investigation at all. And she's sitting there at the desk, and she's combing her hair, and she's just completely nonplussed by any of the other events. And it's, I think it was best described as she's cold, and she just doesn't have empathy for the other main character. And it's unsettling in a film noir, because that role is usually somebody who falls into the arms of the leading man. And it doesn't happen, even though we know that's what the Holly Martin's character wants. You know, she says something to the effect of, go find yourself a girl. He lets her know that she could be that girl, and she just doesn't even react to it. So wonderfully written, wonderfully played.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about now another one of my favorite characters. I love Major Calloway, played by Trevor Howard. He's just your somewhat typical British, you know, official officer, but he has an agenda a lot of the time, which is funny. You know, he's not just there to solve the case. He has stakes in this too. And I love his delivery. I love his attitude, because he's not, a lot of times in film noir, you know, the police are a lot of times portrayed as bumbling and not ahead of everything, but he's on top of everything, which is what I love. Eric, what are your thoughts on Trevor Howard?
Well, Trevor's great in this as well. Yeah. And he plays a sophisticated Brit because he sort of is a sophisticated mm-hmm. Brit. And, you know, we alluded to this a little bit, but Vienna at this time is certainly a character in the film. And he is one of the four occupying countries. He's part of, you know, England, which is occupying sort of a quadrant of Vienna, but then France, Russia, and the United States are all doing that as well. And they're putting together these sort of police squads with members from each of the different countries. And he's really our hero, because the rest of the countries seem to all have a political agenda. His does seem to be, and he may have a political agenda that isn't revealed as much, or I didn't see it, but he really is seeming to be looking out for the citizens of Vienna. So that, in that way, I think he's more of our hero of the film.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, he's like the most obvious kind of moral voice in the film, just because you see there's a air of like just, you know, just complete corruption all around elsewhere, right? Like basically there's the war and then the post-war and the struggles and all that. There's not much good to go around, I guess. And mm-hmm. he's kind of the most obvious moral actor in this. But also, I was also struck on exactly seeing it now, just how posh and British he is. That just struck me in his delivery. Like, you know, that's...
Yeah. And what I love about Trevor Howard is he's one of those actors, he can do so much without moving a muscle. Like, his face and everything is just so calculated. You know, it's kind of like what we talked about last year, Eric, with even though it's a totally different character, but like what Louise Fletcher does in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where the stillness is what gets you, but he has a presence and you totally get enveloped into him. And he's just incredible to watch. I love it. And he's the smartest character in the movie.
He is, and he's got a lot of power, but he's also not threatening, which is tough to pull off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the other big character in the movie, and that's Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles. And talk about a star role, because I think he has the greatest star entrance probably in movie history. I mean, you just think about it, the whole movie builds up to his entrance and it doesn't disappoint. And Raul, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on Orson as Harry Lime?
Yeah. So I watched the intro on the Criterion DVD, and Peter Bogdanovich said something about Orson Welles. Is like, yeah, this is great because it's a star part. Like, he had done one on stage called Mr. Wu, and basically the first half of the movie, everyone's just talking about Mr. Wu, Mr. Wu this, Mr. Wu that, and then halfway through, Mr. Wu shows up, and then the only thing anyone else ever talks about is after that is, wasn't that guy who played Mr. Wu so great? So I think that's what drew him to this movie for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's the, I think I saw Roger Ebert or someone called it, they said he had like a Cheshire cat grin when he shows up. And I think it's that kind of, I mean, he's very playful in his performance, right? But it's also so like amoral, I guess, with like the things he talks about, that's like striking, right? It's hard to reconcile in many ways. Like, he seems playful and fun and like, you know, witty banter. And I guess we'll get to the Cuckoo Clock speech eventually. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's like it's hard to put those two together in a way, right? Like, he's a complex, interesting, and kind of interesting depiction of evil.
Yeah, I mean, and it's layered evil, because the package that you see isn't what you think it is in the beginning, and then the layers, as you learn more and more information, you realize how deep the evil is, and it's pretty stark once you learn it. Eric, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and the scene where he's introduced and there's a light that goes on and it illuminates his face. He could have this sinister look on his face, and the choice is no, he's got this grin, and it's an amazing choice. This is the villain, and he's going to come off as this genial character. So probably the greatest movie entrance. We've talked about him now for an hour and 15 minutes or whatever it is in this movie before he shows up. It's an enormous surprise, and it's definitely that star part. But Orson Welles carries it throughout the rest of the movie too. I mean, there's no doubt that he's at the top of his acting game here as well. The way that he can position his face and profile to the camera and have that grin going on. He can do something with his face that's really tough to do. He can have a grin going on one side. You can only see a portion of the other side of his face, and he's got a sinister look in that other eye. And it's just an amazing performance from Orson Welles. So for a guy that has turned in a lot of amazing performances, that's saying something.
And he only gets 10, 15 minutes of actual screen time. And you walk away from the movie, he's who you're thinking about, because mm-hmm. his presence precedes him almost, because he is so into everything that he is doing. He knows exactly what he's doing at every time. And it's probably because he's a director too. So he knows exactly where that camera's placed. And I guess it's a good time to talk about it as any, but there was rumors and for years saying that Orson Welles really directed this movie. And of course he always debunked that, saying, Carol Reed was a fine director and didn't need him at all. I think he contributed to the Cuckoo Clock speech, but I think that was only his real major contribution to the movie. But you can tell how Reed was certainly inspired by Welles's work when watching this movie.
Yeah, and it is one thing to come in and write part of the script. Mm-hmm. So he knew it was a star part, but he also took the script and said, here's what I want to say. Orson Welles, wonderful actor. I do believe that he didn't direct chunks of this movie. And I think that Reed is an excellent, excellent director.
Absolutely.
Orson Welles came in, though, with his Orson Welles sized ego and said, here's how I'm going to play this character and I'm going to write this. And then, some of the things that happened behind the scenes, he would disappear for periods of time, apparently. Yeah. And they would shoot around him. So there's a lot of shots where we think we're seeing Orson Welles, either a shadow being cast, actually the fingers that come up out of the grates. That's not him. That's other people playing Harry Lime for him.
Yeah. And watching some of those extras. Yeah. So they took 4 weeks to film those scenes in the tunnels. Apparently part of it was because he insisted on using doubles and stuff for a lot of the scenes, but also that Orson Welles refused to be down there because it smelled so bad. So then they had to bring in like scented water and spray down the sewer so that he would be down there. And his Orson Welles sized ego, like you said, but he has such a presence, and it's like you said, he's only in five scenes in the movie, maybe.
Yeah.
Right. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also his influence maybe on the way the movie looks, in terms of Citizen Kane with like the deep focus photography,
right.
Or the lady from Shanghai.
Uh-huh. Lady from Shanghai.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Welles, I think, along with Brando, they're two of those actors that had egos and could drive you crazy, but they always delivered when they were on screen. So you can't, I guess you could cater to that ego a little bit when you knew they were going to deliver.
while we're talking about him, I had a question that I wanted to pose to the both of you. Mm-hmm. Does Harry Lime have a conscience?
I think so.
I don't know. There's moments where you think maybe he really, respects the friendship he has with Holly, but then there's like, oh, he's willing to throw that away. He's willing to throw anything away. I don't think we ever really see a genuine humane moment from him in the movie.
Maybe the one part at the end where it seems like he's looking out for Anna a little bit, or trying to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's maybe it. But yeah, it's hard to find. And actually the other thing I watched this movie with my parents, who are staying with me right now, and they brought up an interesting question, which is, why did he send for Holly in the first place? Like, why did he need him? Like, what is the point of the inciting incident of the movie? You
know? Yeah, they never explain what that job is.
But... and I do think that they were friends. And yeah. What he didn't tell Holly is, I'm cutting you in on my criminal empire. But he did want to bring him in. And, you know, he says it at one point, you're the only guy left that I can trust. Now, that may not be a moment of conscience. It may be you're the only one naive enough to allow me to put my trust in right now. And, you know, I do think that Wells does this really clever thing where he's popping the antacids or whatever he's taking. And he says, these things are tough to come by, but the indigestion, old man, you know, that's getting to me. And we're being led to believe that maybe that's his conscience weighing on his stomach. Like, he's stressed out over the things that he's doing, but it's really just a ploy to get us to kind of feel something for that character, when in reality that guy may be stressed out because he's running a criminal empire and the police are getting closer and closer to him, and that's why his stomach hurts. So I just think that Wells plays that in such a way that it's ambiguous, but at the end of the day, that guy probably is pure evil. And it's just the way that it's played is so clever that you don't taste that immediately.
No. Well, let's move on to favorite scenes. And Eric, we'll start with you. What's a sequence or a favorite scene of yours?
Ooh, everything. I mean, this thing is so meticulously shot. And Brandon, I was going to bring up that scene with the ladder. So not only is it our main character going and getting this bad luck going underneath this ladder, but that is part of the geometry that is all over this movie. So he's going through this sort of triangle, and there's so many times that you see just shapes in this movie, from spiral staircases to shots being framed through bars that make them look rectangular. But to me, that starts from minute one of the movie, and you have this really great opening. It's opening credits like you'd find in the 1940s. And it's the wonderful score that we'll talk more about, I'm sure, being played on this instrument, the zither, which is, from the moment you turn the movie on, it's just a series of lines with an oval behind it. And so you have this geometry that just plays through all of these, that just hits you at the very first moment and then is just perpetuated. And then really all the way to the final shot too, there's geometry involved there. But that to me, that opening shot is a great choice from the minute the movie opens.
Yeah, since you brought it up, we can talk about the score now. The score by Anton Karas, who Carol Reed was in Vienna, and he was, I believe, like a street musician or something, or he was playing in some kind of club, and he was playing this unusual instrument, the zither, and he thought, you know, it was the perfect soundtrack for this movie, and there's no other score like this. And the zither does more sometimes than what a full symphony orchestra could do, because there is something so off-putting and something so almost menacing about it when you hear it, because it's almost like you almost feel like there's somebody constantly peeking at you the whole time because of the score or something. It's always like, ooh, there's somebody behind you. It really, I think, is one of the other stars of this movie.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Go ahead, Raul.
Absolutely. And like, yeah, it's both like whimsical but like completely off kilter, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
So like, and it's kind of mirroring that same tone of Vienna. There's a lot of, you know, there's people going to the theater and like, you know, trying to pretend like nothing has happened while you see like the ruin and destruction and all the horrible things that have happened over the last, you know, and the horrible things that people have done. Like, the, you know, I think there's a character in the movie that mentions like, oh, I couldn't have imagined doing this before the war. Right. And so a lot of people have done a lot of horrible things and are trying to, you know, are living with that. So it's kind of, and like with those Dutch angles and things, it's kind of all of one piece of that same kind of capturing that Vienna at that time. And along with that, apparently Carol Reed, when he's looking for zither players, didn't want someone who was a virtuoso. He said, I want someone who doesn't actually play it that well, who's not that good at playing it. I think, and that's part of it, that it is kind of grating at times, right? And and that's why it works so well.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Holly Martin's, though, too, where he's sort of got this outgoing sort of carefree attitude kind of wandering around, and he's just he's a little sloppy. He's certainly not a virtuoso. He's a and everything that's being thrown at him is sort of disconcerting, and he's spinning in circles a lot of the time, and that music has that circular pattern to it too, that really makes me think of that character. And I find that soundtrack to be sort of bouncy and not as maybe sinister as you had described there, Brandon. But that makes it almost a little more disconcerting to me too, that you don't see the danger when you're kind of hearing this music. You kind of get lost in it when there's all this other stuff going on too. So it's right. Another great choice.
Right. Yeah. Raul, what's a favorite scene of yours?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have to go with Harry Lime's entrance.
Yeah.
It's so iconic and so striking. Or yeah, anytime the music picks up, works so well. And I mean, that and I guess the chase at the end is it's pretty great. Just so many wonderful shots of, yeah.
Yeah, whoever would have thought of that, you know, a chase through the sewers of Venice would have been one of the great chase sequences of all time. But all of those tunnels and the way that and this is a good time to mention the name of the cinematographer of this movie, Robert Krasker. Just his lighting and his use of shadows, it makes the sewers of Vienna, you know, just as scary as any, you know, scary location that you've seen in any other movie, because you never know what's peering around the corner. You know, there's light and darkness, you know, around every corner. And it's such a great set piece at the end. And, you know, it definitely is one of the hallmarks of the movie.
And I think too that those scenes were meticulously planned out, and it's Harry Lime goes from descending into the sewers that seem really vast, and then as he runs through them, and we see sort of the police going to the places where he just was. All of a sudden he's going into smaller and smaller places. He's having to duck into the spiral staircase. He's having to go down into one of the lower tunnels, until eventually he's cornered and he's trapped. And it's just, it just evokes such that feeling of claustrophobia, the more you're in there, that it's a really, really well done sequence.
Absolutely. Well, I guess my favorite scene, I love, you know, the ones that you all mentioned, but I absolutely, you know, I love the Ferris wheel sequence, because there is so much subtext going on in that scene. And so much, I was trying to figure out, Orson Welles goes through so many emotions in like a 30 second slot of that. He goes from wanting to kill Holly to, you know, kind of a more sinister, menacing point, to really, you know, trying to renew their friendship. And it all happens in there. And it's such a mesmerizing but terrifying scene, because you feel like anything can happen in that scene. Mm-hmm. You're like, is he going to try and throw him out of this when they reach the top? And it's two, you know, two very, very different people with two very, very different views on life, you know, discussing just, you know, especially when he's looking out and talking about the dots on the ground, and, you know, would you throw away one of those dots for $20,000? And it's just two very, very differing views on humanity. And it's a fascinating scene to watch.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, you know, we talked about the cuckoo clock part where you're talking about, you know, to recap basically that, you know, Italy under the Borgias had years of, you know, torture and violence and war, and produced the Renaissance, where Switzerland had years of peace, you know, centuries of peace, and produced the cuckoo clock.
Yeah.
But like, okay, I mean, but that doesn't really hold up to what Harry's actually doing, right? Like, he's comparing the Renaissance to like swindling children of vaccines and causing them fake brutality and murder. Like,
yeah, he's not an artist. He's the Borgias, you know. Yeah. He's the, right. the crime family. So it was in spite of those things that great things happened. And I'm again, maybe that's what he's saying is, in spite of me and my presence of the world, great things are going to still happen and come out of Vienna. So why not tolerate me?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about the black market aspect of this movie. Just, you know, there's so many different angles you can look at this movie from, but you know, such a crazy time going, you know, post-war Vienna, and so many things that are actually relevant to today. You know, you were mentioning, Raul, about vaccines and penicillin and all that, and you mentioned that to us earlier today about wanting to touch on that. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, just it struck me on, like, kind of a lot of the dialogue we've seen now about, like, you know, public health and kind of the politicization of public health, especially through, like, the COVID pandemic and, like, you know, politicizing things like masks and vaccines and all that. Like, sure, you make political points, but it's people's real lives that are at stake, right? And that's the thing that's that kind of disconnect that I think is reflected in this movie as well. Like, you know, you people playing, you know, with numbers and all that, but you're not reflecting the actual lives that are at stake.
That, I think that's a great point. And that goes right back to that monologue about when Harry's Lyme is looking out the window and saying, if any of those dots were to disappear, would it really make a difference? And then he even says, other people do it, you know, generals and leaders of countries do it. Why wouldn't I have that choice? And so I think that does ring true in 2020, 2021, when we have leaders that had to make very tough decisions on these things, and history is going to judge them on whether they were right or wrong.
Yeah, and that just brings up, you know, another scene that stands out to me when Major Calloway is giving Holly the tour of the children's hospital. Mm-hmm. And he sees what, you know, what his friend, you know, has basically done. And, you know, and when you think about, you know, diluting that penicillin, and then it makes them, you know, not susceptible to any other kind of vaccines anymore in their bodies. It's just horrible to think about. And, you know, and that final image of the teddy bear, you know, on its stomach, on its face. It's a heartbreaking scene, but it's so important to the movie because it gives you, you know, it's all this fun and mystery, but it gives you the gravity of what's been done here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then just another one of my favorites, because it's just a fun moment. It's when Holly thinks he's getting kidnapped and he's in the runaway car, and it just turns out that they're trying to get him to his engagement on the book discussion. And I love
and Eric, you were talking about how do Europeans view Americans. I mean, that book discussion scene is fantastic. Like, what do you think of the stream of consciousness, right? Like, what about Mr. James Joyce?
Mr. James Joyce, yeah.
Well, and
where
and
do you put him?
Yeah, and Holly's a Pulp Fiction writer, which is what a lot of film noir films were based off of, so it's a perfect comment.
It's meta, on the genre. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of humor in this movie that is subversive. We didn't talk much about him, the Sergeant Payne character.
Yes.
Who loves reading those pulp novels. Mm-hmm. But I also love the lines where a couple of different people ask Holly Martins, what happened to your finger? Oh, a parrot bit me. And they just look at him, and Calloway is like, oh, stop fooling around here. You're in mortal danger. You're talking about a parrot biting you. So there's a lot of fun to be had in this movie too. It's not all dark.
Not at all. Not at all. I also enjoy and it's just, you know, the setting itself. I love how it's the scene where Baron Kurtz is explaining, you know, how Harry, you know, got hit by the car. And every once in a while, the camera will just cut to just random people, you know, a cleaning woman in a window peering out, and then, you know, the porter who becomes more important later on. And it's just this paranoia that is fueling post-war Vienna, and just, you know, everybody being suspicious of one another, which is kind of relevant to today as well. But it gives the place such a feeling of the perfect setting, and it just, you're enveloped in that the whole time, because there is this sense of paranoia throughout the whole movie.
I did have one other question that I wanted to ask, and Rahul, you brought up the ending sequence or the sequences in the sewer. There's a choice. We don't see Holly Martins kill Harry Lyme. Now, we assume, because there's a funeral, that Harry Lime was actually dead this time. But is there any ambiguity to that ending? I mean, this is a guy that has waffled and said, you know, a 20-year friendship's not something you just throw away. Or did he make that decision to shoot his friend, and is he a changed person because of it?
I didn't think there was any ambiguity until you mentioned it now. But, but no, I still think so, because that's, I think, what makes the ending work, is that kind of the Harry Lime's kind of complete amorality and cynicism is kind of the tragedy of it, is that it's dragged Holly along with him, right? And now he's had to go to Harry's level, and it's kind of the moral vacuum at the center of this movie, is that's a tragedy, right? So yeah. I think it works better if it's not ambiguous.
Yeah, and I think Wells's body language, you know, to Holly, you know, about it, I feel like, you know, it's almost like, make this a mercy killing and just put me out of my misery here. But yeah, that's you're right. I didn't even think about the ambiguity of it, because it was always kind of clear to me. But there is when you think
about
it.
Well, and it's just, they made a choice not to show that. And it's not like they chose not to show death in this movie already. Yeah. A few scenes earlier, Payne gets shot and killed.
And that's a hard death to see.
It is. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious why that choice was made. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe there's ambiguity to it. I do think that I think Holly Martin's killed Harry Lime. I guess the only other thing that I could see that as is Harry said something to the effect to Holly, give it to me, I'll do it. You know, yeah. That he saved his friend from it at that final moment. But that's me inserting my sort of story into the movie there.
Well, let's talk about the final scene, the final shot of the movie, which is, you know, just as famous as any other shot in the movie. But such a, you know, as we mentioned, just talking about the character of Anna, such a cold, cold ending. And you think maybe at some point it might get your typical Hollywood ending, which is what one of the producers of this movie wanted. And then there was arguments about whether do you do the Hollywood ending of her actually seeing him and running and them running off together, or do you stick with the way this character has been the whole time, who has just been absolutely, you know, cold and, you know, supported Harry throughout this whole thing. And to me, I don't know, that's the final button that makes this movie unforgettable, just seeing her coldly walk by him, and they shoot it so where it looks like she's even walking past us, the audience, as you're watching it, because she kind of makes that sort of circular turn there out of the camera. But man, that's quite an ending.
Yeah, and I think that the direction that she turns is a deliberate choice too.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about the very end of that, they could have had her duck under the camera and come straight toward the audience. They have her go to the bottom right of the screen when Holly Martin's is standing on the left. Well, their paths diverged, and it just happened right there in front of our eyes, and they're never going to cross again, in my mind. And I think that is a real conscious choice there too.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, she's so cold throughout the whole movie. I was gonna say something, but I forgot what it was entirely. So keep going.
But it doesn't break her character at all, right?
No.
If she had run to him, it would have sort of been out of character with how she acted throughout the rest of the movie toward Holly Martin. So I love the ending of this movie, and I think David O. Selznick, who was the American producer on this, he was the one saying no, it should have the Hollywood ending. She should the two characters should get together, and then he came around on it. He said no, this is the better ending for this movie.
I remember what it was. Just it kind of drives home the kind of unconventionality of this movie. Like, there's not, I can't think of many other movies that are at all like this, right? Kind of everything is kind of anti what you expect, right? Like the kind of upbeat but kind of jarring score, you know, the cheerful immoral killer, the bumbling hapless protagonist, the chilly, you know, main female character. Like, it's kind of all put together to drive home, like, things are not what you expect.
Yeah, it's very subversive to to Hollywood and to the genre itself too.
Yeah, and it's because I feel like movies and TV in this day and age are all about subverting expectations. Back then it wasn't, so this was totally something new. And I'm sure had this been financed by an American studio, it would have gotten the happy ending. But I think British cinema at the time was much more about do the more realistic, you know, see the character's through line all the way through. And so that's, I think that's why it happened, but I'm glad it did, because it's such a cold, you know, just thump to the heart when you watch yeah. it, even though Anna hasn't given you any reason to really care for her at all, you know, you still kind of just as a human being hope, oh, maybe she and Holly can find some happiness, but you know, he'll go back to America and, you know, write another book. any other scenes or any other aspects of the movie that you would like to talk about?
I mean, I just think that, and we've hit it all already here, and Rahul mentioned the Dutch angles in this film.
Yes.
I mean, there's not enough time to talk about how this thing is shot, and the Dutch angle is if people aren't aware of that term, it's where the camera is sitting at an angle so that it's almost precarious for the characters being shot, and the whole movie is shot that way. But one of the most striking visuals to me is the scene where the sting has been set up and Holly's going to meet Harry in the cafe. And we think that Harry's approaching the cafe, and you see this enormous shadow across the town square of Vienna. And then it turns out to be the guy holding balloons. Mm. And in the foreground of the shot are these gargoyles from Vienna building that's probably hundreds of years old. You've got these wet cobblestones, you've got this enormous shadow backlit, and you think it's another great big reveal of Harry Lime, and they subvert it right there too. And so to me, that was just another way that they're going to that the director and the cinematographer are playing with our emotions throughout this whole movie. And it's just, to me, that sequence, you could watch that and be like, okay, this is a great movie right here, that 30 seconds.
And I mean, we've touched on it a little bit here and there. It feels like, I mean, overall, it is. I mean, there are lots of funny parts in this movie, right? But it's kind of grappling with the tone that I think a lot of people were going through at that time of, like, you know, it's not mentioned at all, but like obviously there were the Nazis and the Holocaust and that sort of thing, and you know, that's casting a huge shadow on this movie, right? And you know, later there was the, you know, Hannah Arendt was talking about like the banality of evil. Like, I mean, this is that in human flesh in the form of Harry Lime, right? Like, you know, there's no reason for him. I mean, he is so petty that it's kind of pointless. And I think it's kind of grappling with that moral weight of the horrible things that have just happened in the world that is kind of driving this movie.
There's a whole political undertone that we haven't even really touched upon, that Russia is now viewed as sort of the evil empire, and they're sort of cast that way in this movie. People are suspicious of their motives. And then it's kind of funny too, because the scenes where the police enter Anna's apartment, you have representatives of the different countries, and they sort of, I love that the French guy was just like, sorry, we are here. And it's just like, that's how the French were viewed, as kind of, they just laid down and let people walk all over them. But there's a real political undertone too, that we could spend another 20 minutes talking about, that I'm not sure we have time to dive into.
Well, and the fact that they shot this, you know, in Vienna, and you see all the rubble, mm-hmm. and you see all the ruins around there, it's like, you know, the ghosts of what had happened just a few years earlier, they yeah. permeate the whole situation. So there is a, you know, it's a, like we said, it's got its quirky fun moments, but there is a dark cloud over the whole movie the entire time.
But even they call that, the narrator at the beginning says, oh, it was bombed about a bit.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's just...
It's striking, because could you imagine something like that happening now? Like, no. Right? Like this sort of movie, like I couldn't imagine, like, you know, it's this sort of production happening now. Like, just, you wouldn't
know. We would see it now as post-apocalyptic. You know, we would see it as The Walking Dead, where the world has changed, but it was their reality.
Yeah, and I mean, this is just 4 years after World War II, so you think how fresh it still was in people's minds. So it's, yeah, it permeates through the whole thing. One other shot that just popped into my mind that I loved is when the porter and Holly are arguing in the apartment, and the little boy with the ball comes up and is watching them argue. And it's totally from a child's eye view perspective whenever you see, because the camera is so low to the ground and you're looking up, and you can just imagine, you know, the little boy and what he thinks is happening. And, you know, of course we get that scene later on where he's, you know, we don't know exactly what he's yelling, but everybody's accusing Holly of being the murderer. And it's just, it's a wonderful, another shot that you don't get anything like it in the rest of the movie. There's so many little instances of just one or two things happening that never happen again, and it just keeps the movie, it keeps you off your off kilter, you know, just like the just like all the different shots, because you never know exactly what's going to happen. So let's, as we sort of get to the point where we do wrap up and conclusion here, the movie did very well when it came out. It was held in a grand gala world premiere at the Ritz Cinema in East Sussex in England. It was the most popular film at the British box office in 1949, and was nominated for 3 Oscars. Carol Reed was nominated for Best Director. It was nominated for film editing, and very deservedly, Robert Krasker won for cinematography. It deserved a lot more Oscar nominations, in my opinion. But I think probably it being a British film probably might have hurt it with Academy voters. The winner of the Best Picture that year was All the King's Men, which is a fine movie, but doesn't stand the test of time necessarily like The Third Man does.
Yeah, and you know, I think of this movie sort of like Orson Welles wasn't a big deal in Hollywood.
Not anymore.
And you know, his reputation was as a difficult person, and I think he would have struggled to find work in Hollywood. This wasn't a big Hollywood studio picture. It wasn't even a Hollywood film noir where, you know, we're gonna reveal the gritty underbelly of something. This is probably a movie like Casablanca, though, where it was put together, and over time people have said, wow, that movie really works in so many different ways. Or like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, where it was kind of on the slate and just made, and it did well at the box office and it won its awards. And then time has said, okay, there are a lot more things that we need to look at in this movie that weren't recognized at the time.
Well, yeah, and you meant,
I think so. I think it did win the Palme d'Or, though. So I think there was some critical recognition of it at the time. But yeah, I think its stature as a classic has grown over time, where maybe it was recognized as like, you know, a well-made movie or like a powerful movie, but not like, yeah, like now considered the greatest British film of all time. I think that's definitely grown.
I think a lot of people, and you mentioned Casablanca, and a lot of people consider that movie a happy accident. You know, it was a lot of people who knew what they were doing that came together and made something that was greater than what they had expected it to be. And I think that, you know, everybody was expecting Lawrence of Arabia to be great when it came out. Everybody was expecting Gone with the Wind to be great when it came out. But this is one of those movies that I think caught people by surprise. And then, like Casablanca, like Wonderful Life, only grew in stature over time. And to me, those movies tend to be the ones that we all keep coming back to, because they aren't necessarily even of their time. They're just that they were put together by talented people who knew how to make a movie, who knew exactly what they were doing, and told a brilliant story. And that's why, and that's why they sort of go beyond their years, I feel like. But also, even though it's considered a British film, it was on the American Film Institute's list of top 100 movies in 98. It was number 57. And then it was also number 75 on the most thrilling movies of all time. And it was number 5 on the greatest mystery films of all time. And Harry Lime was the 37th greatest villain in movie history. So a pretty good showing lately. But yeah, I think you talk to a lot of critics and you read like the list of their favorite movies. This is on a lot of people's lists of their favorite movies, because I think, like I said before, you can find something new every time you watch it. And it's not just you know, your typical mystery thriller. It packs a gut punch, like I said in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and everything is so intentional, right, stylistically, mm-hmm. that I think that's what also makes it hold up. That, like, even for its time or any time, it's so striking to even a modern sensibility that, you know, it's so unique that way.
Well, and it's not like Carol Reed went on to make a lot more movies like this, you know. Mm-hmm. Orson Welles kind of had that formula and did those two films after Citizen Kane that were sort of stylistically similar and then decided he didn't want to do anything like it anymore. But Carol Reed, correct me if I'm wrong, he went on to do like Oliver, a big movie musical.
He made a movie the year before this called The Fallen Idol, which is a wonderful movie that we need to talk about sometime, British film. And he did a lot of these types of movies and then sort of became, I guess I wanted more mainstream later on or whatever, but he did movies like Oliver, and Oliver's the one that won him the Oscar eventually. But
yeah, which is a fine film, but it's not put together like this. It's not subversive at all.
No, it's a straightforward, does what it's supposed to do.
Right.
This movie, you know, there's so much more attention to detail with this one and so much more, you know, literally, you know, him directorially doing something interesting in every shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So as we sort of wrap up here, I can't believe, it's been an hour. Hard to believe we've been talking. It's gone by like that. But Eric, I'll start with you. Final thoughts on The Third Man.
You know, there's another hour worth of talk here too, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you have a movie that dense, we glossed over some of the highlights, but it's almost required watching too. And it's almost required watching multiple times to sort of get a feel for the things that you miss the first time around, because there's a lot more going on underneath, which is kind of the plot of the movie too. So I would put this in certainly my top 10, probably my top 5 all time favorites of movies. So I think everybody listening, if you haven't seen it, you better go. You should have paused 45 minutes ago and watched it, but definitely go check it out now.
Yeah. Raul, final thoughts?
Yeah, I gave up on making top lists a long time ago because they're too hard.
It's hard.
Yeah. But it holds up so well, and there's so much there. But, you know, there's a lot of heavy stuff in it that we've talked about, but also that it's just engaging and fun to watch. It is fun to watch.
It is.
Like, it's very easy to watch. It's not a drag. It moves at a very solid pace, and, like, you know, such great performances and, like, so many interesting things going on all the time. So yeah, I mean, and the, like, stylistic choices and the interesting musical score. Yeah. So it's great. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's like a great, it's like a great page turner. It's a great book. Like, if you, it's hard to stop in the middle. Like, if you get done with one scene, you got to turn the page to see what happens in the next scene, because, like we said before, there's something interesting going on every second. And it really is, it feels modern when I watched it. It doesn't feel dated at all. It feels like it could have been made, you know, last year, 5 years ago, because I think the score helps it, because it keeps it kind of quirky and unusual, and the editing of it, and it doesn't feel, you know, some of the movies of that period where you just stick a camera in front of two actors and just let it sit there. There's something really, really interesting going on all the time, and you've got one of the great, you know, screen performances of all time by Orson Welles in just, you know, 15 minutes of screen time. So even that's worth it. And there's always something that you'll find new when you watch it. It's worth coming back to. So I hope you stopped before we got into it and we didn't spoil it for you, if you're still listening, because otherwise you missed out on some fun surprises. But even if we did spoil it for you, it's a great movie. Go and watch it, because there's so much more that we didn't talk about. But as we wrap up this episode, Raul, thanks so much for joining us. This was great.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Look forward to the next one.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, Eric, we got a lot of fun stuff coming up. Do you just want to give a preview of a couple things?
So what's really great with doing The Third Man right now is we're going to take a look, another look, a second look, classic second look at Citizen Kane. My self-professed favorite movie of all time, certainly a great influence on this movie. I'd love to be able to talk some of the parallels with that one, although we are having Aaron McCabe join us for that discussion. And what the great thing about that is Aaron had not seen this movie previously. So this was her first watching of that film. And I'm not sure that she's ever seen The Third Man, but can't wait to get her take as someone who's never seen it on that film, especially in 2021. And so I guess the other reason that we're doing that is that movie came out in 1941. And so we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of Citizen Kane. And then later on in May, we'll get another visit from the wonderful Patricia Kelly, Gene Kelly's widow, to celebrate another anniversary, the anniversary of the film An American in Paris. So we look forward to having her on to hopefully share some wonderful stories about that movie and sort of reminisce on that wonderful picture as well.
Yeah. A lot of fun stuff coming up, a lot of great movies to talk about. And like always, if you want to request a movie, you can always email us at classicsfrn@gmail.com. We will definitely look into it if we haven't done it before, and we'll discuss it. We'll discuss it as long as we don't infringe on our friends at Flashbacks. Just make sure it was made before 1980. Other than that, you can also find us on Instagram at FRN Classics Pod, and you can also find us on Facebook at Front Row Classics Podcast. And just engage with us. We love talking about movies, request a movie. We'll put up more polls and fun things for you to look at and watch. So yeah, we love keeping up with our listeners. So we are going to wrap up this episode of Classics. And for the Front Row Network, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Rahul Raghunath.
Thank you.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.